The headlines: Iran says reaching a sustainable deal on the revival of the JCPOA requires practical and verifiable measures by the U.S. Iraqi media say a major U.S. military base near the capital Baghdad has come under a rocket attack. And also, a top Russian official warns of NATO's nuclear threat as the standoff over Ukraine shows no sign of letting up. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Iran says it has a serious will to reach, in the shortest time possible, a good agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The comment was made by the Iranian foreign minister, who spoke with UN Chief Antonio Guterres over the phone. Hossein Amir Abdollahian described as positive the process of the ongoing talks in Vienna on the JCPOA revival talks and the removal of sanctions. He pointed out to a lack of trust in the U.S., saying a reliable and lasting agreement requires practical, tangible, and verifiable measures by the West and Washington. Guterres, on his part, welcomed any progress in the Vienna negotiations, which are underway between Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories. The U.S. is taking part in the talks indirectly because it withdrew from the 2015 deal and reinstated sanctions on Iran. And diplomatic efforts are ongoing in the Austrian capital to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA, which was derailed by the unilateral withdrawal of the U.S. This is the eighth round of such talks between Iran and the remaining parties to the deal. Our correspondent, Tom Olesky, has been following the talks in Vienna, and she now joins us with more details. Oma, over to you.
Yes, Fadia, the eighth round of these talks is still underway, and today there was another meeting between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Barghani-Kani, and the EU coordinator, Enrico Mora, followed, we were expecting, with the talks with representatives from the three European signatories of the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, as well. And these meetings have been ongoing for days and days now. We also had yesterday, a meeting between the Iranian and the Russian side, and Mr. Olyanov, the Russian ambassador, in a recent tweet said that he doesn't rule out that the talks can be, at this stage, expedited through the joint efforts of all the participants, because he had earlier suggested that the talks can reach a conclusion by early February. Then there were reports that maybe that unofficial, so to speak, deadline has been extended a little bit, and the sides are going to say some more. And Mr. Olyanov said that he believes, again, in that tweet, suggesting that if efforts are increased and the process is expedited, then maybe they can conclude by that time. But there are also those who are saying that the sides still need at least some weeks before they can come to a conclusion. We also had remarks in the news coming from a top White House official, the Middle East coordinator, saying in one interview that he was familiar, of course, with the process of the talks with the indirect involvement of the U.S. And he said that there is a chance for a deal to be reached, but also there's a chance that there will not be a deal and that the Americans are prepared for both scenarios, although he also said we are in the ballpark of a possible deal. So there is a bit of vagueness there for maybe those listening from the outside. Is there going to be a deal? Is there not going to be a deal? When we talk to sources close to the Iranian side, they tell us that this is because the talks are now at a very advanced stage. Most of the technical or legal work or the drafting has already been done by the experts. What's required now, these sources say, is the political, important political decisions that need to be made. Once those decisions are made at the higher levels, then things can move on pretty quickly, because now the decision has to be made, they say, by the Americans. Are they going to lift the sanctions that need to be lifted, that Iran believes need to be lifted, not just the JCPOA-related sanctions, but those that have been imposed under the Trump administration, which Iran believes are in fact related to the implementation of the JCPOA? Will the U.S. be willing to give guarantees that it will not withdraw again, that it will not reimpose sanctions? And can these sanctions removal, the sanctions removal attempts, be verified? So these are the questions that require political decisions. Also, sources close to the talks have been saying that there have also been demands that Iran deems unacceptable when it comes to its research and development activities that Iran is not going to accept. So we'll have to see if these important decisions are made and if the sides will be able to reach a conclusion.
All right, thanks a lot. Omar Lezgi joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Elsewhere, Iraqi media say military base housing American forces near Baghdad's international airport has come under attack. According to the media reports, a base known as Camp Victory was attacked by 6 rockets. Still no word on possible casualties or material damage. There is no immediate claim of responsibility either. Camp Victory and other U.S. military bases in Iraq have frequently been attacked in the past months. The incidents have grown since the U.S. assassinated top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and a senior Iraqi commander in January 2020. Both were key anti-terror icons. Their assassination gave a rise to calls for the withdrawal of American forces from Iraq. Northwestern Syria has been the scene of clashes between the Daesh terrorist group and U.S.-backed militants guarding a prison in Hasaka. Damascus says the whole episode is an American scenario.
This is Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka. It is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueyran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists use explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say, we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when, I mean, that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism. But in reality, it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, Bassam Sabbah, said the U.S. is behind the deadly clashes in the northeastern province of Hasaka. Speaking at a U.N. Security Council session on Wednesday, he warned that Washington is seeking to revive the Daesh terror group to justify its occupation of resource-rich parts of Syria.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halt its support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabbah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Welcome back. The Russian foreign minister says his country is not seeking war with neighboring Ukraine.
If it depends on Russia, there will be no war. We do not want wars, but neither will we allow for our interest to be blatantly violated, for our interest to be ignored.
Lavrov made the remarks today after the U.S. and NATO responded to the security demands raised by Moscow. However, Russian President Vladimir Putin says their responses do not address Moscow's principal concerns. In a phone call with his French counterpart, Putin said Russia would closely study the responses and then decide on further action. Moscow wants NATO to stop its eastward expansion and never admit Ukraine as a member. The U.S. and the Western alliance have rejected this demand. They in turn accuse Russia of planning an invasion of Ukraine by massing troops along the border. Moscow says the military buildup is for defensive purposes. Russia says the Western military alliance NATO is developing the capacity for nuclear strikes against Russian territory. The country's top arms control official, Vladimir Yermakov, has spoken of what he called joint nuclear missions between NATO countries. He says in those missions, non-nuclear NATO members are housing American B-61 nuclear bombs. The Russian official says the same members are taking part in training sessions to develop American nuclear capabilities aimed at his country. He has urged an end to those missions and says all American nuclear weapons must return to U.S. territory. The Russian official said these demands were included in a list Moscow presented to the West in December. And Iran is reporting more COVID-19 infections, while the number of fatalities remains relatively low thanks to the country's mass vaccination campaign. Figures from Iran's health ministry show over 16,000 new cases have been detected in the past day. Also, the virus has claimed the lives of 23 people in the same period. Iran's health minister says a sixth wave of the pandemic has begun in the country as hospitals report increasing numbers of admissions and outpatients due to the highly contagious Omicron variant. Health officials are urging people to get booster jabs. So far, over 16 million Iranians have received a third dose of a COVID vaccine. In total, over 130 million COVID shots have been administered, which covers the majority of the Iranian population. South Korea's COVID cases keep surging, with the country logging yet another record in its daily infections. South Korea posted more than 16,000 new infections for Thursday. That's the highest daily case number there since the start of the pandemic. Daily COVID infections hit record highs on Wednesday and Tuesday, too. They've been rising steadily in the past 2 weeks because of the Omicron variant, which is highly contagious. Health authorities in South Korea are now warning that daily caseloads could surge to five-digit figures in the coming weeks if the current pace of the Omicron spread continues. The government has extended restrictions on businesses to contain the virus. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro denounces the opposition for its attempt to recall a referendum against him.
The attempt to reactivate the revocation referendum by the opposition against the president was a major fail. It's stupid, it's childish, and it's part of the attacks the opposition has carried out in Venezuela over the last few years.
Venezuela's National Electoral Council has declared the president's opponents did not collect enough signatures for the vote against him. The bid needed 4.2 million signatures of support to go ahead, but according to the Electoral Council, roughly 42,500 were received under Venezuela's constitution. Officials who have completed at least half of their term can be removed from office by a vote. President Maduro completed the first 3 years of his second term just earlier this month. The opposition blames him for the existing economic hardships. Maduro says U.S. sanctions, including those on oil, are to blame. Lebanese resistance fighter and Europe's oldest political prisoner, George Ibrahim Abdullah, is back in French courts trying to finally win his freedom. The anti-imperialist hero has been subjected to nearly four decades in prison due to pressure from Israel and the United States. Rami Mazari has more from Paris.
Julian Assange may be Europe's most famous political prisoner, but George Ibrahim Abdullah is the continent's oldest prisoner of conscience. For over 37 years, the Lebanese activist, called the Nelson Mandela of the Arab world, has been jailed in France in a flagrant politicization of the country's own judicial system, which has authorized his release on three occasions. In 1982, Abdullah's resistance group accepted responsibility for the death of Israeli and American agents in Paris. They said they were the legitimate acts of resistance against a foreign occupation as Israel had invaded Lebanon yet again. Abdullah was back in court to demand France finally release him because the expulsion of alleged terrorists from French soil has become systematic. The court's decision is expected February 10th. Trial was noted for its lack of proof, and his own lawyer later confessed to betraying him. Many say he has been made a sacrificial lamb for two dead alleged spies, with major pressure coming from the United States and Israel.
The political pressure on France in this case has always been from those who support Zionism. Zionism is the political doctrine of France, so it does whatever it can to protect it. The Muslim minority in France supports justice for the oppressed, but we have no influence to stop their vengeance against Abdullah or against innocent Palestinians.
Many believe Abdullah, a Maronite Christian and avowed socialist who refuses to abandon his beliefs, is exactly the type of unifying and heroic figure who could unite a fragmented and battered Lebanese nation. Many believe the only way France will release him is in a prisoner exchange, but Abdullah's arrival in Lebanon could destabilize an ever-precarious status quo where France remains the power broker, even post-colonization.
French visitors describe Abdullah's mood as good and that he remains politically active and committed to the causes of the oppressed peoples worldwide. In turn, Abdullah is not just a hero to the Arab world, he's become a global icon for anti-imperialists, socialists, and internationalists. Amin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
The first crop of antivirals against SARS-CoV-2 is promising, but new drugs will be needed to counter the looming threat of resistance, says Max Kozlov-Ryder in an article published under the heading Why Scientists Are Racing to Develop More COVID Antivirals. Stay tuned for the details. The rollout of COVID-19 vaccines at the beginning of 2021 marked a key turning point in the fight against the global pandemic. Another major milestone arrived at the end of the year with the approval of two oral antiviral treatments that promised to reduce the number of COVID-19 hospitalizations and deaths. But as these pills slowly make their way into pharmacies worldwide, researchers are already looking ahead to the drugs that could supersede them. These are our first-generation antivirals against coronavirus, says Sarah Cherry, an immunologist at the Prelem School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Our experience with antivirals against other diseases like Hepatitis C and HIV proves that we can do better and better over time, she adds. Clinical trial data showed that Molnupiravir, developed by pharmaceutical firm Merck based in Kenilworth, New Jersey, and the biotechnology company Ridgeback Biotherapeutics in Miami, Florida, caught hospitalizations and deaths by 30% compared with people who took placebos. Many other countries have followed suit with their own approvals, and many are negotiating with the drug makers to buy courses of the drugs or to manufacture their own generic versions. For now, the pills are in short supply. Drug makers are still scaling up production of the antivirals, which are in huge demand to treat the highly transmissible Omicron variant. But when they become more widely available, and if their clinical trial data is borne out in the real world, the pills will become vital tools to prevent people from becoming seriously ill with COVID-19. It's too soon to tell whether SARS-CoV-2 is likely to develop any resistance to these first-generation antivirals, says Tim Sheehan, a coronavirologist at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Although its sky-high rate of replication is a breeding ground for mutations, he says, the virus also causes acute infections that offer relatively little time for resistance-causing mutations to accumulate. But the threat of resistance is particularly severe for monotrapies, such as Molnupiravir and Paxlovid, that each target only one part of the virus. That's why it's imperative to develop new antivirals aimed at different targets or ones that can be combined into single treatment to attack the virus on multiple fronts, says Sheehan. Successful antivirals have typically targeted two key pieces of a virus's biological machinery, a polymerase and a protease, both of which are essential for viral replication. The current COVID pills are no exception. Paxlovid inhibits SARS-CoV-2's main protease, whereas Molnupiravir tricks its RNA polymerase into incorporating part of the drug into the virus's RNA, creating so many errors that it cannot survive. A third drug, Remdesivir, developed by a company based in California, inhibits RNA polymerase, but treatment is expensive and currently requires intravenous infusions over three consecutive days, making it inaccessible to many people. Researchers should also develop treatments that target other parts of the virus. This time, scientists got lucky with a virus that encodes both a polymerase and a protease. And here they are, 2 years later, with only a suboptimal arsenal. They really have to identify and validate new targets for antivirals so that when the next pandemic happens, they have a much broader pipeline to choose from. Other potential targets include a different protease in SARS-CoV-2 called PLPRO and an enzyme called metatransferase that stabilizes the virus's RNA. Developing such broad-spectrum drugs will take significant public and private investment, and the cooperation of pharmaceutical companies. Calls for such efforts were not heeded in the wake of the 2003 SARS-CoV-2 outbreak, but the latest pandemic has underlined the need for action. Last year, the United States appropriated $1.2 billion to NIAID to launch the Antiviral Drug Discovery Centers for Pathogens of Pandemic Concern, which will fund basic research on developing antivirals for 7 virus families. This gives scientists hope that antiviral research will continue even as the COVID-19 pandemic wanes. But all antivirals face an inherent limitation. They must be taken within days of infection to stop a virus from proliferating. Antivirals are only effective if people acknowledge that they might be ill and can access tests that provide a timely diagnosis.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, coordination of factors and elements of training or raising children. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of coordination of the factors and elements of training or raising. Generally, what we see is that we have a spiritual environment in the house. We have an Islamic environment in the house. And that's what we are following. We teach our own traits to the children. But when they go out and when they go to the school is 100 degree, we can say, opposite of what we are training them in the house. In the house, we try to make them someone who is purified, the someone who goes towards perfection, and Islamic, through the Islamic teachings, we are trying to make them the best people of the society. But when they go to the school, they learn a lot of things from their teachers, from their classmates, from the friends who they have outside. So whenever they're outside the house, the things are different from what they see within the house. So therefore, there is no coordination between the elements or factors. And we can see even in the environment which they are facing, they're facing maybe two kinds of environments or three kinds of environments. And this is dangerous for the kids. And therefore, we need to pay attention to this element, the difference of these elements or factors, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of coordination of factors and elements of training or raising kids. We said that when we train kids, when we are trying to, we are raising kids, obviously, within the Islamic society, within the Islamic environment, we try to raise our kids. And because the in-house environment is Islamic, therefore, they are facing an environment which is purely Islamic, which is according to the Islamic teachings. But as soon as they go out, they see other factors, they see other environments which is against the Islamic teachings. And on top of that, when they go to the school, the teachers have their own methods of teaching. For example, when they want to talk about the justice, they explain it according to their own perspective, or the Western perspective of justice, not the Islamic. And even within the capitalism or the system that we have, obviously, that has its own impact. The secularism has its own impacts on the kids. Therefore, the things are not matching. The factors are not matching. The factor of school with the factor of the house is not matching. Therefore, we need to take care of this, that if you want to choose a school for your kids, it should match the environment of the house, the school's environment, or the friends which they want to choose. It should match the environment that you have provided them in the house. Therefore, you need to be careful when you're raising kids that they have good friends, or the friends who are same in faith which you are following. And this can prevent a lot of confusions that are raised in the kids in future. So therefore, we need to match and have coordination between the environment that we have within the house and the environment which is outside the house, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
As groups debate the effect of the Rittenhouse verdict, the legislative stalemate shows no signs of changing, and weapons on the street grow. The news analysis you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Glenn Thrush. The piece is titled "Rittenhouse Case Highlights the Nation's Deep Division Over Gun Rights." Days before Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted of murder, the judge in his case tossed out a charge, illegal possession of the military-style semi-automatic rifle he used to kill two people. The withdrawal of the misdemeanor charge, which carried a maximum sentence of less than a year, was a footnote in a much bigger drama. Yet, it was a telling reminder that the Rittenhouse case, in addition to examining the polarizing issue of race and the right to self-defense in the country, highlighted the growing proliferation of guns on America's streets, and the failure of efforts to enact even modest new gun restrictions. While the government remains mired in stalemate on gun control, weapons purchases are at record levels. The run on ammunition has become so frenzied that gun shop owners have had to turn away hunters heading out for the winter big game season. A spike in the firearm-related homicide rate during the pandemic has overwhelmed local police departments, and the proliferation of homemade firearms, or ghost guns, has reached epidemic proportions in California. Gun control advocates thought they could make some headway under President Joe Biden, but have faced a backlash. For the advocates, there have been some gains, including a pending ban on the online sale of kit guns and $5 billion in new violence prevention funding that was included in the social spending passed by the House hours before the verdict was announced. But congressional Republicans have blocked efforts to expand federal background checks on gun purchases and restrict the sale of semi-automatic guns, or even to confirm a permanent director for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives. All of that has limited the White House to adopting a series of executive actions, including new regulations on ghost guns and accessories called stabilizing braces that can effectively turn a pistol into a short-barreled rifle. The regulatory changes are likely to provoke legal challenges. A ban on assault weapons like the one that Mr. Rittenhouse carried lapsed in 2004, and Republicans have blocked its renewal. In the wake of the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict, gun control supporters face another, much more significant setback, with a conservative majority on the Supreme Court likely to strike down or seriously weaken a New York State law that imposes strict limits on carrying weapons outside of the home. We are really disappointed with the outcome of the trial, and we are really worried about its implications in the case before the court, because they both deal with the same issue. Whether people have the right to carry a loaded gun in public, said T. Christian Hain, a survivor of gun violence who is now a top official with the Brady Campaign, one of America's biggest gun safety organizations. Gun laws have generally become more permissive. Open carry is now legal to one degree or another in many states. A majority of Americans support stricter gun laws, but a Gallup opinion poll last year showed that support for gun regulation, which surged after a mass shooting in 2018 at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, has ebbed during the coronavirus pandemic and a spike in violent crime. Other opinion polls have showed continued strong support. Josh Horwitz, the executive director of the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence, which monitors firearm-related homicides and suicides, said that extreme gun culture had become pervasive. Only in America can a 17-year-old teenager grab an assault weapon, travel across state lines, provoke a fight, kill two people and injure another, and pay no consequences, he said, after the verdict on Friday in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Some black Americans viewed the verdict as more evidence of racial disparity in judicial outcomes, a perspective that extended to the discussion around the right to bear arms. The Reverend Al Sharpton contrasted the acquittal of Kyle Rittenhouse with the federal government's aggressive, at times violent, campaign against the Black Panthers and other black groups that cited self-defense and the Second Amendment as justification for arming themselves. There's a huge double standard, he said in an interview, arguing that a black man who did what Kyle Rittenhouse did would have been convicted in 2 hours. The National Rifle Association, the NRA, which has backed Stand Your Ground laws to expand the legal defense for gun owners who shoot people they perceive to be threatening, responded to the verdict by posting portions of the Second Amendment on its Twitter page. A well-regulated militia shall not be infringed, it wrote, minutes after the jury delivered not guilty verdict on 5 counts facing Kyle Rittenhouse, including first-degree intentional homicide. Other advocates of gun rights were still more outspoken. Representative Madison Cawthorn, a North Carolina Republican, urged supporters to become armed and dangerous. The Gun Owners of America, which has staked out a position to the right of the National Rifle Association in hopes of capitalizing on the larger group's recent leadership and financial woes, on Friday, 19th of November, announced its intention to send Kyle Rittenhouse, now 18 years old, a new AR-15 rifle in reward for his defense of the Second Amendment. Join us in saying thank you to Kyle Rittenhouse for being a warrior for gun owners and self-defense rights across the country, the group wrote in a post on its Twitter page. The legal notion of self-defense, a doctrine that has long been cherished in the United States, has been complicated by the ongoing proliferation of guns. Defendants can assert that they were entitled to open fire because others could wrest their weapon from them. During the shootings in Kenosha, Wisconsin in August of 2020, after unrest over a police shooting, many people had guns with them. One of the people Mr. Rittenhouse shot and wounded had pulled out a handgun. A police officer testified that so many armed people were roving around the area that when Kyle Rittenhouse approached with his hands up, the police officer made no connection to the shootings that had occurred earlier. Wisconsin, a politically divided swing state, reaction to the verdict was perhaps more muted than elsewhere. Nick Clark, president of the Wisconsin Carry, a gun rights group, said the verdict would only deepen a stalemate over firearms legislation in his state. He said he did not expect that a contentious and long-stalled bill that would allow Wisconsin gun owners to carry their weapons without a special transit permit would gain new traction. If Kyle had been convicted, there would have been a massive chilling effect on people coming to the scenes of urban unrest with their guns, trying to help folks protect their property, Mr. Clark said. But you know, I think there will be a chilling effect anyway, he said. I don't think people want to endure the kind of thing that Kyle just went through, so I think they will think twice about picking up their guns and coming when this happens again. Jerry Bonavia, who runs the Wisconsin Anti-Violence Effort Educational Fund, a gun control group, said the decision was a win for the fringe that would encourage right-wing groups to brandish their weapons at protests, leading to more bloodshed. The vast majority of Americans will never carry a firearm in public, but there are people who will feel emboldened now, she said. It is a dangerous situation. Although the weapons charge against Kurt Rittenhouse was dropped, the case against his friend Dominic Black, a 19-year-old who purchased the Smith & Wesson military-style semi-automatic rifle for him at an Ace hardware store in northern Wisconsin in May of 2020, is still pending, with a court hearing scheduled next week. Dominic Black faces two counts of intentionally giving a dangerous weapon to a person under the age of 18, causing death, and could face up to 6 years in prison if convicted, though legal experts are now saying Kyle Rittenhouse's acquittal will greatly bolster his defense. Yet the failure of prosecutors to secure a conviction or even successfully pursue a weapons charge against Mr. Rittenhouse underscored, at times, confusing and inconsistently enforced state firearms regulations. When it comes to guns, Wisconsin sits roughly at the midpoint between Republican-controlled states that have been systematically loosening rules and Democrat-controlled states that have been increasingly applying strict controls. Gun owners in the state are allowed to carry weapons in public because there is simply no law restricting them from doing so, said Tom Grieve, a Milwaukee-based defense attorney and former state prosecutor who specializes in firearms cases. There was no dispute that state law superficially bans children and minors, like Kyle Rittenhouse was, from owning guns. But the fine print of the state law contains a provision that exempts minors in some cases, including if their rifle's barrel is at least 16 inches long, Mr. Grieve said. The Smith & Wesson M&P-15 that Kyle Rittenhouse had strapped around his shoulder had a 16-inch long barrel. Mr. Grieve said he was not entirely sure how the provision got on the books, but that he believed Judge Bruce Schroeder made the correct call in the Rittenhouse trial. In March, after 7 mass shootings, President Biden vowed to push for a new ban on assault weapons like the one that Mr. Rittenhouse used. President Biden said it should not be a partisan issue, but White House officials privately concede that there was virtually no chance of succeeding in a deadlocked Senate, and Democrats have not made the issue a top priority.
Just listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat
or Bad 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to RIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Aqa on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very interesting tradition, which has been narrated from the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. In this beautiful tradition, the Prophet alludes to one of the etiquettes of prayer and dua. And that etiquette, and that thing that he's alluding to, is the fact that one should try to make prayer when the heart is tender. And when, first of all, when the heart is tender and the heart is observant of the prayer itself and also the person, the being who he's praying to, in other words, God. By tenderness of the heart, we mean that when the heart is not hard, you know, when it's not constricted. The Quran and the Hadith, they offer and they give a great importance to the qalb, or the heart. If you a casual glance at the different verses of the Holy Quran and the Hadith which have been narrated regarding the qalb and the heart, it can attest to and affirm this fact. And this is also this tradition we're going to narrate for you today. It also alludes to this fact the importance of the heart. In the sense that when the heart is in a tender state, meaning when it has, in the words of this tradition, a riqqat, and it is aware of God and it's concentrating on God, when it's pondering over the being who it's praying to. Right. This is this state, if the person makes prayer, the prayer will be answered. In this beautiful tradition, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "Seize the opportunity to supplicate during tenderness of your heart, for verily it is a mercy." Right. This is a mercy. In other words, like, this is a state in which God Almighty is having mercy on you, and when you pray to God in this state where God Almighty is having mercy on you, the chances of your prayer being answered are increased. And we have some traditions which have been narrated which state that when you see that it's raining, make dua, make prayer. Why? Because there's a time when Allah's doors of mercy have been opened, right? So when the doors of Allah's mercy have been opened, and you make a prayer, the chances of your prayer being accepted are more, right? In a similar fashion, we have another tradition, which has been narrated also from the Holy Prophet, in which the Holy Prophet says, "Know that Allah does not answer supplication from a heedless and distracted heart." Right? So a heart, when it's distracted, meaning when it's distracted from the being that it's praying to, for example, you might be praying and reciting a dua, Dua-i Kumail, or you know, another dua from the Mufatiul Jinan, but because you're so used to praying it and you memorized it, right, you no longer think about the meanings of the prayer, what you're praying, and your heart becomes distracted, right? This decreases the chances of your dua and supplication being answered. So you should take heed of this when you're praying next time. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Aqa for the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This spotlight.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight, I'm Kavitat Wai. It appears not all European countries are in sync or in step with U.S. moves when it comes to the nuclear power nation. Germany has said that it will not supply Kiev with weapons for now, something which has drawn the anger from Ukraine. Is it because of Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will examine why Germany has taken a